Why the Working Class and Socialist and the Labor Movement.
And my name is Scott Fitzgerald. I'll introduce myself more fully in a few minutes. What we're going to do is explore those questions. Right? Why the labor movement in particular, why the working class, and then what does it look like to be a socialist in the labor movement. We're going to start with Bhaskar Sunkara. He's going to give us an overview of, like, try to answer the question, why the working class? And then I'm going to focus more specifically on the rank and file strategy. And then Karen Baker. Karen Baker, a fellow teacher, is going to talk about, like, maybe some of what this looks like in practice. And then Laura Gabby is also going to talk about a carpenter and what, like, this looks like in Andhra. Okay. So, Bhaskar, please take it away.
Hi, folks. My name is Stephen from Solidarity. Right now, you're expecting to hear Bhaskar Sunkara, who joined us remotely for the day school. But unfortunately, the recording quality was mostly inaudible, so we decided to remove it at this time. We've asked Bhaskar to re-record this segment, and when that happens, we'll update this recording. We want to thank Bhaskar for participating in the panel and look forward to working with him again. So the recording will now pick up just after Bhaskar's presentation. Thank you.
Now that Bhaskar has kind of, like, set the scene, why the working class, we want to kind of get into some more specifics. I'm still going to stay at a fairly, you know, I guess, general level in terms of talking about the rank and file strategy, and then we're going to hear about what that might look like in practice. And so I can start by saying my name is Scott Fitzgerald. I'm a teacher in a Boston suburb. I'm a member of Solidarity. I'm a building rep, which is what we call shop stewards in teachers unions, and I'm active in Educators for Democratic Union, the progressive caucus in the MTA, the Mass Teachers Association. That has had some success over the last number of years of actually beginning the transformation of the MTA. So I want to thank the organizers for asking me to be part of this, and thank everybody for being here. So I was asked to talk about the rank and file strategy, so I just want to quickly clarify how I approach this topic. When I'm talking about the rank and file strategy today, I'm talking about the ideas developed primarily, though not exclusively, by the International Socialists in the 1970s, carried on by Solidarity beginning in the mid-80s. And almost everything that I'm saying today comes right out of a pamphlet written by Kim Moody in the year 2000 called The Rank and File Strategy. It's really an amazing document. You should read it. Read it in groups. It's great. It's a work of history. It's a work of theory, sociology, and strategy. And it's just a really important document. And again, it's like also the distillation of decades of work in the labor. So my plan today is to briefly say what the rank and file strategy is not. Give a very quick, working definition for what it is. I want to talk about some of the underpinning understandings that make the rank and file strategy possible, and then talk a little bit about, like, okay, what does this look like in practice? All right, so what is the rank and file strategy? Again, what is it not? To start off, I think it'd be useful to say what the rank and file strategy is not. It's been gotten a lot of press lately. There's all sorts of articles now going around about the rank and file strategy, and it's understood radically differently by radically different people. And so, you know, that's fine. But in terms of what I'm thinking about, it's not a strategy to transform more abundant business unions and to rebuild the labor movement. It's not a way to achieve important social democratic reforms as a result of the political activity of transformed unions, though both of these things will be the effect. What the rank and file strategy is, and now I'm quoting from Kim Moody, is a strategy for ending the isolation of socialists and socialist organizations from the day-to-day struggles and experience of the organized sections of the working class. Continuing on, this is a key component for building a revolutionary socialist workers movement in the U.S. The strategy really is to end the divorce between socialists and most of the working class in all sorts of ways, right? Situating historically and remembering that that's the task is, I think, really essential. There are some key, I'll come back to the discussion about what it is more fully in a bit, but there are some key understandings or claims that underpin the strategy, and I think it's important to kind of separate these out, and some I'll say a little bit about, and some maybe we can talk about together later. But there's like six claims that I think are underpinning this, and none of these will come as a surprise to anyone, I think. But I think it's important to note that in the rank and file strategy document by Kim Moody, he doesn't just assert these, you know, there's a theoretical explanation, there's an analysis for why all of these are the case, right? So the first one, Bhaskar addressed it, the working class is the vehicle for socialist transformation, right? And so I won't say more because Bhaskar did a pretty good job outlining that. Second, in no particular order, there is a militant minority. Well, I want to talk about that word in a bit, but there are working class leaders that already exist within the working class. But this militant minority, it's small, it's isolated, and it's not exposed to socialist ideas in any meaningful ways. And so we're talking about ordinary working class folks. They're well-liked, they're well-respected. They're leaders in the only meaningful sense of that word, meaning that they have followers, right? They can get people to do things. They can get their coworkers to take action. They're the people that that everybody goes to when they have a workplace issue or they have a question or concern. They're not necessarily union activists. They may not identify with the union. They're seldom the most vocal workers in the workplace, but they're willing to take militant action in defense of themselves and their coworkers. And so these are the people that need to be highlighted, identified, and then their ranks need to be grown. But then again, in terms of like the overall strategy of the rank and file strategy, politically, this is a collection of people that are all over. You know, they might be good in the workplace, but then many of us would find some of their other positions really difficult to handle. Third claim or understanding is that among the broad layer of working people, both organized and unorganized, there is an acceptance of what Kim Moody, following Gramsci, calls capitalist common sense. Mark Fisher calls this capitalist realism. Margaret Thatcher spelled this out nicely when she said there is no alternative, right? Like the idea that in this moment, there is a common sense that most people, even workers and unions, have come to accept as this is the economic system that makes the most sense. It's natural. You know, we can think about maybe making some adjustments here and there, but this is basically as good as it gets, right? The end of history kind of thing. Among some members of the working class, there is a consciousness of what Marx would call a class in itself. So meaning that there's an awareness of the idea of like the working class as a class in itself that has distinct interests that are separate from the bosses. But, you know, that for the most part, that's the extent of what you'll find. But even this kind of like, you know, class struggle consciousness is pretty low. You know, and again, I've had a couple of experiences both in the Teamsters and the teachers unions where, you know, this very much lines up with my thinking, even amongst some of the best colleagues and best co-workers in terms of being good union folks, right? Class consciousness was often pretty limited. And for a lot of people, it's just simply not there, right? I mean, you know, I'm sure you've been in a position where you're supporting a strike and you see all sorts of people crossing the picket line. Like, you know, ordinary people don't understand. If you haven't been brought up in a union household or been taught this, right? What does a picket line mean, right? And so we kind of at a very low level of consciousness. And so in order to get to socialist consciousness, we need to kind of raise folks up to working class consciousness. Kim Moody identifies a number of factors that have resulted in the consciousness of the U.S. working class over the last couple of centuries. But I just want to stop and talk about one for a second here. Moody identifies the distorting effects of racism in U.S. society and its deep roots in the historical process of the development of the working class. And again, I think that's key because Moody acknowledges the importance of not just, you know, engaging with what some people might call class reductionism. We need to fight white supremacy and male domination in the process of the development of class consciousness. So I just want to quote a somewhat lengthy excerpt here from Moody. He says, "We want to make it clear that we do not proceed from some faceless, raceless, neutered idea of the working class. We endorse the thoughts of the Caribbean revolutionary, Aimé Césaire, who rejected the crude Stalinist version of class universality held by the French Communist Party when he resigned in 1955. In his resignation letter, he wrote, I have a different idea of the universal. It depends on your rich. It depends. It is a universal rich with all of that is particular, rich with all the particularities there are, and deepening of each particular, the coexistence of them all. Nowhere does the diversity shape the particular. particularities of the working class more than in the U.S. Nowhere is this diversity more central to the divisions, diversions, and strengths experienced by working class people in different ways. Nowhere do working class people see themselves and one another in such different, usually distorted ways. The prism of race in particular is highly distorting of class perceptions, even though in different ways for different groups. Although it is also a source of class strength for many people of color, indeed the problems and potential diversity is a theme we return to again and again as we address questions of consciousness and organization. Right? So yeah, I think that's important. That's always been a key component of the rank and file strategy, identifying the ways in which certain workers are especially oppressed and being aware of that as you think about how to do your organizing. Okay. So the fourth kind of understanding is that the link between revolutionary socialist left and the militant minority have been severed for historical reasons. But again, I'm sure many folks aren't unfamiliar with in this room, but Moody goes into a lot of detail explaining it and the rank and file strategy. Fifth, consciousness is complex and develops unevenly in a variety of ways. And it is when people are in motion, particularly when they're fighting their employer, that they become open to bigger ideas, including socialist ideas. And then sixth and lastly, most U.S. unions have become hierarchical, bureaucratized institutions led by people unwilling to organize the membership or challenge employers in any meaningful way. Right? And again, we all care about this, the sclerotic nature of the U.S. labor movement, right? But then that begs a really important question, I think, which is, so why unions then, right? If unions are like, you know, have all of these flaws, all of these problems, why should socialists still be worried about them, right? And there's debate over the extent to which this is the place where socialists should be. Well, so again, a couple of answers for that. First, it makes sense to go where workers already are organized with structures in place that are ripe for repair to build them from there, right? So there already are these organizations with extraordinary potential. So let's take advantage of those organizations and build them from there. Unions are also organizations with the most potential social power and are certainly the organizations with the most resources to fight the bosses and their politicians. And unions are places where workers are organized as workers, which is where most experience the negative harm of capitalism. And unions are places where workers can learn skills and develop their consciousness so they can take the struggle to a higher level. And lastly, unions are also, despite some notable exceptions, and without ignoring the often racist and sexist history of many unions in the U.S., they're amongst the most socially integrated organizations in American life. So there's lots and lots of reasons for why we should identify the union as the place of struggle. And again, that doesn't preclude other forms of organization, but there's a lot of potential. Okay, so the broad outline of some of the kind of the theoretical understandings of the strategy. So what does this look like in practice? And so back to the fundamental problem that the rank and file strategy is attempting to address. According to Moody, the left, with its highly theorized, often moralistic politics, and the worker activist with an untheorized, pragmatic outlook, are often like trains passing in the night. The rank and file strategy is an attempt to bridge that gap. Okay, so. So what? You're convinced of the need to organize amongst workers. You're convinced that it makes sense to try and get a rank and file job within a union. And so you do it, right? If you're a socialist who's willing and able, the first step is to get a rank and file job. You know, there's lots of debate about the importance of choosing strategically significant industries, right? That's something we could probably talk about after. I will say, well, I think it's important to be thoughtful about where you end up. I think just as important as thoughtful who you end up with there. This isn't something that can be done alone. So I was alone in my building until my friend and comrade, Mike Chilton, ended up in my building. And the two people in the building, is what we're able to do between the two of us is much more than the sum of our individual capacity. So find people that you can do this with. It's really important to remember when we enter the ranks of working people, we are not going there to bring the answer or propagandize for socialism. And we are not necessarily, we are not primarily there to teach workers what they need to do. Our job is to learn from our coworkers what their issues and concerns are, help move them to collective action, and be an internal, integral fighter in the collective struggle. What we're pushing here is class struggle at the point of production, which, of course, is the best school for learning class politics. What we want is our coworkers to take collective militant action. And then when people do that, the effect often is that they come to realize their power. They see what's possible in a way that wasn't the day before, right? So this kind of common sense that is, you know, that just is an aspect of everything that we do, of all of our lives. This common sense begins to be challenged, right? We can change things. We do have power in the workplace. We can actually achieve some of our objectives. And when we help to rebuild this militant minority, we can increase the size of this of class-conscious workers in which self-conscious socialists can swim, right? And so ultimately, we do want to bring socialist ideas to working people, but the only effective way to do that is in the context of a militant, class-conscious working class, right? If that's not already there, then, you know, if you're going to go in with your newspaper and your correct line on every position, it's not going to be well-received, and rightfully so, right? And so you need to go in, build relationships, learn along with your colleagues, be part of the struggle, and remember that this is a long-term goal, right? I had a really good conversation with one of my union mentors the other night about some issues I was having in the workplace, and, you know, she just kept reminding me about, like, your task is to find something that's going to move these people, and it's probably not going to be the thing that you want them to move on, right? And so in for the long haul, build relationships, get to know people, have lots and lots of one-on-one conversations. Figure out what's going to make people move. You never know what's going to be the thing. And again, the last couple of years, I've had the experience on a couple of different occasions of just being surprised at what people will move on. And then I think had some pretty cool victories. Okay, so let me just wrap up with how the document kind of wraps up here by saying, the strategy laid out is one that embodies the politics of socialism from below. It emphasizes the revolutionary potential of the working class. The workplace is a site where the working class confronts the contradictions of capitalism most directly and the strategic importance of trade unions and socialist interventions in them. It's a strategy of building rank and file power on its own terms from within, understanding that people are compelled by their own circumstances to engage in class struggle. It's a strategy that sees the process of class struggle and the rank and file organizations that emerge as bridges to more militant action and more revolutionary politics. With the help of socialists embedded in the labor movement, the existence of a strong current of active class-conscious workers is a precondition for the development of a strong current of socialist workers and a socialist party. We need to be at the same time bringing our socialist ideas directly to workers who are ready to hear them and also help create the struggles that produce more such workers. So I think that there's, you know, obviously tons more to say. I'm tempted to Moody quotes from the Percy Shelley speech. I'm tempted to go there, but I think I'll just wrap up by saying, obviously there's lots more to talk about, right? Obviously transitional demands, transitional organizations, right? What role do they play in any of this? But I think I'll stop now and turn it on to my co-team.
Okay, tell me if I'm not loud enough, or whatever, let me know. My name's Karen Baker. I've been a teacher for 20 plus years. The last 11 years I've taught in Amherst schools in Western Massachusetts. I'm a member of Solidarity and also of Pioneer Valley DSA. And I use she, her. So I'm going to talk about Educators for Democratic Union. And towards the end of preparing for this, I started thinking, you know what I really haven't done is completely like brought it to the last, John's main point in some ways, it's sort of there, but we can also get to it in discussion as far as the rank and file strategy and what EDU is, how EDU relates to it. But basically my understanding is the idea of my talk is, so the rank and file strategy, we talk about it in this abstract way, but what is it like when you're doing it? So Educators for Democratic Union, I've been a member since the first official statewide meeting in 2012. And to give you an idea, I've been consistently involved since then. I wouldn't call myself like a central mover and shaker, like on the periphery of that. So that's kind of the perspective. I've been experiencing it from. There are other core members here who can also offer their perspective at some point. We may not always see things exactly the same. And so to give you a little bit of a history of it, I'm going to talk about kind of where EBU has been, some challenges we've faced, some achievements we've had, and like ultimately get back to difficulties, I guess, and on that note. But so as far as what is EBU, people may be somewhat familiar with it. It started, as I said, in 2012. Two UMass professors helped launch it. One, Dan Clausen, was also a Solidarity member, a central key member all the way through until last spring when, unfortunately, he died. And that's been really hard for all of us. He was so many things to so many people, including Education for Democratic Unions. We really miss him. The other, Max Page, is the current vice president of MTA. And he is because EDU decided to run him and do very good campaigns. And Marianna Jimmy ran as president with him, and she also won. So Max and Dan and others had been frustrated about the direction that Massachusetts Teachers Association, which is the statewide combination of all the NEA locals in Massachusetts, the direction they were going. John mentioned unions being hierarchical and sclerotic, and those are definitely words that would describe MTA, very top-down, service-oriented, and so on. And I kind of bumped into some of the stuff that was frustrating people when I first got involved in my local, going to union meetings, and my president explained to me that there was this group, Stand for Children, which is like this dark money-funded ed reform group that's popped up in different places around the country. And they had a plan to do this ballot measure in Massachusetts that would eliminate seniority rights, would tie teacher evaluations to testing, and on and on. All of these, there's this vast list of things it was going to do. And MTA had done polling, and it turned out that it would win. And so therefore, MTA leadership in their wisdom decided, without telling anyone, very secret backroom deal. Even people on the board at first didn't know about it. And then when they did, they weren't allowed to speak about it. They decided that they had to make concessions and make a deal with Stand for Children. And they ultimately, in their victory, gave up seniority rights in some cases. And as a result, got it off the ballot. So they didn't lose all these other things. It could have been worse and so on. And so people felt like, really? At the time in this meeting where my president explained this to me, I was so confused. Can't we just educate people if they understood why these issues are, maybe they're in favor of it now, but once they hear from us, that was not considered. So then contrast this to the period later on, Barbara Mattaloni had a campaign in 2014 that EDU ran. Dan was her campaign manager, and she won. She easily fits the bill of a militant socialist leader, and here she was president of 110,000 plus combination of unions in Massachusetts Teachers Association. Shortly after that, there was another ballot measure. This one, question two, was going to raise the cap on charter schools, not just in terms of number, but in terms of the percentage of school budgets that could go to charter schools. That has also been capped, and it was pretty much going to blow it all open. But this time, with Barbara in the lead and other leadership also being shifted because of EDU campaigns to get people on the board and so on, we chose at our annual convention to fund a campaign, a No On Two campaign, and although the initial polling said question two would win, so of course the old leadership would have figured out some way to give away everything except a few items or something. Instead, we fought it and won, defeated it by a landslide. The polls were basically reversed by the time we were done. Barbara ultimately won another term, And that was really shocking to the old guard in MTA, who thought, well, the first time was a fluke, but we successfully got her in office again. And then when she turned out in 2018, Mary and Jamie, as I mentioned, and Max Page are now president. So president and vice president. So when people tell the story of UDU, that's the story that you often hear. But I want to get a little more deeper in the weeds. As far as the rank and file strategy, the idea of reform caucuses is a big part of it, right? And so here's UDU, this reform caucus inside MTA. But how does it actually work, and what are some of the on-the-ground challenges? So, of course, and I think part of the point of me talking right now is it's different in every case in many ways. So I wanted to use as some examples, you know, what do people think of when they think of school employee struggles? They think of Chicago Teachers Union, they think of West Virginia. And if you look at both of those examples, they're so different than the situation that EDU finds herself in. Both of them are relatively cohesive units, they also have, I think, more optimal numbers. So in terms of the unit situation, yes, Chicago, clearly, it's one school district. But even West Virginia, when you hear about the outcome of their successful strike, one of the things you find out is that they got a 5% raise from the legislature. The legislature is who they negotiate with. So even though there are 55 districts, in many ways, they're all together with this one clear target. In terms of numbers, too, there's 1.8 million people in West Virginia. Chicago itself is 1 million more than that. But MTA is operating in a state of 7 million people, so much larger scale. And we're working with many more separate locals, 289 in MTA. So as a reform caucus, it doesn't really work to, I mean, I'm sure it would be great in some of the larger locals if there were active EDU like chapters or something within those, but pretty much we've always operated on a statewide basis. And so this is the scope, you know, how do you have the one-on-one conversations that people have mentioned, you know, like this is the way you organize with 110,000 members divided into all these places. You know, we're not really, I'm sure that we don't have, we have people in many different locals around the state, but I'm sure we don't have people in probably most of the 289 locals that exist. So this is a big part of our challenge. So let's see, on my next page here. So after 7 years of existence, you know, we're still in this situation. I was thinking, as another way to put it too, you hear Jane McAlevey's ideas of the way to organize is you have to chart your building. So how would you chart? And you've got to do it on paper too. I don't know if you've heard her talk about this, but it can't be electronic spreadsheets. So imagine the number of pieces of paper we have to chart our organizing arena as EDU. So in spite of the challenges, we have truly had some very remarkable successes. MTA is visibly transformed in many ways. We may not be like the all-out fighting force for public education that we would like to see, but we have our moments. I already mentioned the No On EDU success, and that was definitely, let's see, I'll get to that I think later. So that wouldn't have happened if EDU hadn't campaigned to get Barbara elected. The whole thing wouldn't have been launched. In fact, you can see this clearly, the Walton Fund did a post-assessment of the Question 2 campaign, and they have, I'll quote from one section of it, you can see this online. They wrote, the union opposition to Question 2 was unprecedented, so they just never anticipated that this would happen. The new president, elected in 2014, pioneered an uncompromising opposition to Question 2 and mobilized a grassroots campaign of teachers by attacking charter schools as corporate interests. So, you know, Doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? And EDU did that. Of course, let's see. And this is important also to understand in the context of Massachusetts is kind of like, you know, the flagship education state. And so if they had been able to take and privatize and profiteer off of the education system in Massachusetts, you know, that would have been, it would have made it so much easier to move into the rest of the country. So it was very significant that we stopped that. There's been a similar campaign that we've been working on the last year plus. People may have heard of the Fund Our Future campaign. I was going to describe a little bit of the basis of what it is, but maybe I shouldn't in the interest of time. But we have had a suggestion that we will be successful. It hasn't been wrapped up yet, but there has been a bill that has come out in the legislature within the last week or two that does many of the things that MTA and EDU was advocating for. And again, you know, would that have happened under previous administrations in MTA if we hadn't had the ability to influence the funding and all the things that we've been able to accomplish? And as far as that too, a little quick plug. On October 3rd, there's going to be an event that is going to try to push that this bill that is coming forward that is looks pretty good, is successful, doesn't get watered down, and also that some of the negative aspects to it are hopefully unattached from it. So if you're available on October 3rd, look for something like that, because that will be important. So other successes that I've seen include like more diffuse things in out in Amherst. I've noticed that my local operates differently over the last last 5 years, say. When I first became a building rep, our rep council meetings consisted of like three officers giving reports. Everybody would sit and listen, and then we'd all leave. And that was the meeting. And now there's much more. The reports happen, but there's more discussion. We vote on things. There's been organizing efforts that have come from the rep council and so on. So, you know, people there don't necessarily connect that to EDU, but I think there's a way that it's not accidental that that's happening now. I talk to more and more people who've been involved in something called the Next Generation Training in my local, but in other areas. And that's basically a labor notes training that MTA is now holding on a regular basis, and many, many people are going through it. That wouldn't have happened if we hadn't done what we did. There's a group in Western Massachusetts, WEMEAN, Western Mass Educators Action Network. It's like a solidarity network that people from different locals attend. And again, these things are all kind of bubbling, and I think they're part of what we've accomplished. Again, to our challenges, failures, limits at this point. So a lot of it boils down to, I think of it, I measure it this way, in terms of, I think of it in my mind as strike envy. So over quite a few years now, you know, there's been the Red for Ed movement around the state, teacher strikes and so on, and there's been talking to you, you know, how we could see ourselves doing that. And when will our moment be, sort of. And the idea with the Fund Our Future campaign was that we would launch it at the beginning of last year, and the hope was that we would start to talk to different locals and maybe find a few key ones that could agree to some kind of strike action if and we let the legislature know if by May 1st you haven't agreed to what we're asking for in this new funding system that we're striking May 1st. That's the deadline. But the thing is, you know, back to what I was saying about all these different locals and the number, the scale and everything, we just didn't have the base to build for that and make that happen. So that's kind of where you see the limits of where we're at. The challenges. Similarly, I don't know, how many people have heard of MTA saying that they're going to strike for the climate strike MTA voted for. I've heard that a lot. And I want to clarify that the way I understand what happened is that the annual meeting last year, there was a vote, but it was a very specific and narrow. We voted in favor that some representatives of MTA would go to the NEA convention and speak in favor of the idea of a climate strike that teachers would be involved in. But that was all that we really would be able to consider because it might be illegal and this and that. But it would be, so it's like this very hypothetical. We voted in favor of the idea of discussing the idea of striking or something like that. So that's cool. But, you know, sometimes you hear, I get the sense that people think, well, we're that close to having this massive teacher strike in Massachusetts or something. And so far, I would say that is not where we are. Anything else? Oh, look at all that. I think that's pretty much what I've already covered. So successes, challenges, not quite sure how to get beyond this soon.
My name is Laura Gabby, she, her pronouns. I'm a carpenter in the Carpenters Union. I got into the Carpenters Union 7.5 years ago. I didn't go in with an idea of pursuing like the rank and file strategy. At that point, I thought of myself as being somebody like vaguely on the left, and I was an activist in a few different things, but I hadn't ever been connected to any socialist organization or to like any real big left organizations. I worked in an office job. I hated it. I had a ton of student debt, and I needed something. I was really low paid. I needed something that paid more. So I just started looking around and playing with a bunch of different ideas. I spent my whole life playing sports, so I was like, maybe I should really be doing something physical. I had I'd worked with an ex-boyfriend's uncle for a little while, tiling floors, and I loved it, and the day passed so quickly, and I was like, maybe I should, you know, I went to college and all that, but maybe I should just do something totally different. So I went into it like purely because I actually wanted to be a carpenter, not knowing anything about the union, about the dynamics, about even, this sounds very naive, but even about how conservative the building trade unions are, just kind of went in blindly, and like positive about the labor movement, but you know, but that was it. I immediately jumped in and wanted to get involved in my union. I immediately found out that there were a lot of things going on that seemed really, just to be blunt, really fucked up. Like right away I was hit with that. I was like, wow, this is not this is not what I thought it would be. When I got in, there was a fight. A contract was being negotiated. There'd just been two big locals merge. There was like lots of weird infighting. The contract, there was this big fight going on around what's called full mobility. Which essentially the contractors wanted to have the ability to 100% choose who they hire on jobs, whereas it used to be, it was like 50% were from the hall, 50% the company could choose whoever they wanted. Having the strong hiring hall is, I think, extremely important in the building trades because we, jobs come and go quickly. You know, you can be laid off very easily. It's not like in most unionized workplaces where there's like strong just cause, and you can't be, you know, if you're a union activist, it's somewhat hard for them to just get rid of you. In the building trades, that's really not as much the case because of the fact that you can be laid off so easily. They can just say, oh, there's not that much work anymore. So the hiring hall becomes really important. Like if you know you have a strong hiring hall, you're willing to take more risks because, you know, because if you get laid off, you just go back on the list, get sent out to another job, it's not the end of the world. So this is what the fight was going on around. I was going to the meetings, I was seeing people get up and speak very passionately about this. It was people of all political persuasions. I sort of fell in with that group, and they had there's kind of a loose group that regularly runs like a rank and file slate for elections, for both the local elections and for delegate elections. I got involved in that group. However, it constantly seemed like something was kind of lacking. It was like there'd be a lot of activity around election time. There'd be really low organizing activity between elections. It wasn't as formal as a caucus. Even within that, there was some weird infighting. But that's kind of how I initially like got my foot into this. I spent honestly a number of years like as a union activist, just kind of trying to do what I thought was right, push what I thought was right. Before I came to DSA and found out about this thing called the rank and file strategy. So flash forward to 2016. I was a Bernie Sanders supporter. Trump got elected. It became abundantly clear. I'd known before this that capitalism was just like fundamentally fucked up, but I didn't consider myself a socialist because I didn't feel like I'd done enough reading to like call myself a socialist necessarily. And Trump got elected. A few organizers who I knew and respected were joining DSA at that time, and I was like, this is where it's gonna be at, I guess. I'm gonna join DSA. Immediately started meeting a lot of other labor activists. And something to understand too, which people probably know, but the building trades, not only is it like isolated from the left, but it's also it's often very isolated from the rest of the labor movement. Like it sort of thinks of itself as its like own separate little thing. So it was like a real experience for me to suddenly be in touch with like tons of different labor activists and other unions. Talking to people, finding out that they had very, very similar struggles, including in unions that I did not expect at all. Like I vividly remember talking to an activist in the teachers union in New York at my first labor notes training, and we were talking, and we were like literally dealing with the exact same like shit in our unions, and I was like, wow, this, you know, this would have been nice to know. So I got involved in DSA. I read Kim Moody's his rank and file strategy pamphlet. It's interesting that you quoted that, one of his lines actually that I have written here as well. The line that I'm sure a lot of people have heard before, but that the left with its highly theorized, often moralistic politics, and the worker activists with an untheorized, pragmatic outlook are often like trains passing in the night. That line, honestly, when I read that, I know I sound totally cheesy, but I cry easily, so I believe that I actually cried when I read that, because it was like, it was a huge shift in like culture shock for me to begin with, to go from like I studied public health, it's 90% women, going to like 97% male field. It was this massive shift. But I got so immersed in that then returning to DSA and sort of returning to the left was again sort of another shock, and it constantly felt like I was like trying to straddle two very, very different worlds or something and like bring them together, and it just wasn't. So I read that and I was like, my heart is stabbed. That's like exactly my experience, because I really believe that like both worlds like very much need each other. Like it's just so abundantly clear to me that like it needs to be together. So essentially what John laid out was like the idea of like bridging this gap between between those two worlds. What that's looked like for me since finding out about the rank and file strategy, and the other big thing about the rank and file strategy was like I was going about things trying to do what I felt was right and fight against what was wrong at sort of a gut level, but it connected me to kind of like a much broader vision of what it was that I was actually fighting for, which I think was extremely important. And I think is important too in terms of like being a long-term fighter in this, because I was at a point where I was feeling sort of broken down. We had some losses and I wasn't connected to this broader vision. And then the broader vision showed up. So what Bridging the Gap has looked like for me has been essentially slowly trying to bring like friends and coworkers in the carpenters and in the building trades, first connecting them to labor notes, then connecting them to DSA, being thoughtful about what I've been inviting people to. I don't like willy-nilly invite people to everything. I tend to make sure that it's like really, really relevant, often labor stuff that's going to be, that directly will help with some sort of fight that we're dealing with in the building trades. So I've slowly been sort of like building up a broader group that's connected. I've also since found, since openly identifying as a socialist, I've since found other people in the carpenters who I thought of as like progressive, but have like since come to me and been like, I think I've been a socialist this whole time. One of my closest mentors was like, I've never been able to say it because it's been such a taboo, but I'm, he now openly calls himself a socialist. So that's been really cool, to sort of be discovering that. And, and he's also said too, like this younger generation is sort of like, inspiring me to be more bold. Like he's like, you guys just talk openly about it. Like it's fine. Whereas in my day that didn't really happen. So let me see. Sorry, I'm lost in my notes. Thanks. So the other part of trying to bridge this gap has been within DSA, working towards bringing more DSA, and I'm focused on DSA obviously because that's the left organization I'm part of. But this obviously can apply to other left or socialist organizations. But it's been focusing on bringing DSAers to strategic industries. I'm part of the labor branch in New York City. We spent a lot of time debating what sort of industries we'd consider strategic. We ended up picking six. One of them just narrowly made it in the vote was actually the carpenters. I was honestly a little bit like nervous about it for a while because I'd heard throughout my time in DSA, I'd also heard a lot of like sort of misconceptions about the building trades, about who works in the building trades. I think there's still very much an image that it's just like a bunch of old white guys, and like why would we kind of bother with a bunch of like old white guys who are like who'd probably be difficult to move on some of these things. Well, the building trades obviously have a really nasty history in terms of like racist exclusion. It's not the case anymore that that's who the membership is. In New York City, the carpenters are 45% people of color. The laborers are 2/3 people of color in New York City. So, and some of the building trades, there's pockets where it's still a lot of old white guys. But overall, it's like very, very diverse group of people. And also, it's not, there's definitely very conservative members and there's some right wingers. But I broadly feel like there's a lot more people who are just kind of apolitical and very disengaged with politics. There's also progressive and left people. So I was a little bit hesitant about this or worried about it because I'm like, I feel like there's these misconceptions. I don't know if people would really want to get into the carpenters or building trades. It's since panned out that there's been a lot more interest than I expected there to be. We've had people applying. There's been There's interest particularly in sort of the connection between the building trades and being able to win things like the Green New Deal or move towards eco-socialism. Seeing that this is a group of workers that's going to be like fundamentally key in this transition, because it's going to be people that are actually doing the work. So there's been kind of a lot of interest there. That's where the interest has been building, and people have actually been acting on it and going ahead and applying and, you know, learning more about the rank and file strategy. So that's been extremely heartening to me and exciting. I only have 1 minute more, but I guess I'm going to skip ahead to talk a little bit about the, just kind of a brief overview of what like organizing in the building trades looks like. We've unfortunately had a few like major defeats. Most of my wins have been like small wins. The sort of job site things that people care about, again, are not always what you like dream of organizing about, but a lot of times it's stuff like sanitary bathrooms. Like the bathrooms really suck. Safety standards sometimes, they'll ask you to do really, really crazy unsafe things. There's this kind of like masculine culture of like you have to go tough it out and do it, until you start finding out that like people really, really don't want to like go risk their life, you know, for a job. So those have been some of the smaller things that I've been able to successfully organize around. There was there were two campaigns in the past couple of years that sort of have been at a broader level, bringing the different building trades together. The first one was around the high number of deaths in the building trades, especially in non-union work. In the past 3.5 years, there's now been a total of 69 deaths in New York City, in building trades jobs. And it's weirdly totally unspoken about. A group of us started a campaign a few years ago around it. It was, Local 79, the labor's leadership, spearheaded it, but it was also a lot of the ideas were rank and file members. So there were some rank and file members who decided that we were going to go and have like a candlelight vigil outside of every single job site where somebody died and inform the public and make it this like big thing. And that was again something that sort of I felt was expanding class consciousness, because the building trades usually is not fighting for non-union workers. It's usually like we're kind of very narrowly engaged in our own thing. This very much shifted that. It was suddenly like people were going and talking to non-union workers at these jobs, and people were suddenly, I watched people's views shift on immigration, which didn't go as broad as I would have liked it, for sure. Like it stayed to sort of this like smaller activist group that was involved in this. But nonetheless, it seemed like one of these interventions that's bringing about, like at least first bringing about some sort of like working class consciousness. And there's some more examples, but I've gone on too long, so I'm gonna stop there.
Okay, so it's 1 o'clock. This was supposed to go until 1:15. I think we did start a little bit late. They've said that we have a lunch break that's an hour and a half long. That seems long to me. I'm a teacher, so. I guess we need to see how it goes. We can take the next 15 minutes for questions, and then if people have more, maybe we can continue the discussion. So, do folks have questions or thoughts they want to share? Why don't we go to Donna? All right.
I'm Donna Cartwright. I use she, her pronouns. I spent about 30 years of my life implementing the rank and file strategy, even before I had that name, starting with it founding the International Socialists in 1969. And, I believed in it then, and I believe in it now. I believe that socialists, if they want to influence the working class, the best way to do that is to work with the working class, work in the working class. And I certainly felt borne out by that in my own experience, but there's a but coming on this, which is that we who get immersed in union activity and union agitation tend to get tunnel vision about unions. We tend to think that everything is about unions. And it's funny for me to say, because at work I was, was union was part of my name, but we have to remember that unions are an adaptive response of the working class to capitalism. And that, in a sense, they wind up with a kind of equilibrium with capitalism. And very often the conversations that we have with people in the workplace don't go any farther than that, don't go any farther than we need more, better, stronger unions. That's all true. However, there is that last mile conversation, which is that we're about something more than that. We're about a new world, a different world. And very often, in my experience, that was the conversation you never got to, in the long run, because it just seemed to be a little bit too much, or because the people were not receptive, or, whatever. But I want to get at is somewhere in there, and I'm glad that actually, I'm so delighted to hear that you had that conversation with somebody who would never have said that they were socialist until they met you. So, again, what I want to say is that, the operative part of the rank and file strategy is to rebuild a socialist and communist layer in the working class. And it is not just enough to be the most militant person in your work site. You have to think about how to take it beyond that. I will close with that.
I'm Mary Dodge. Thanks for a fantastic panel, and Donna, thanks for your contribution. I think I'm going to follow right off of that. So I haven't recently read the rank and file strategy. So my first question is very quick. I'm assuming that the opposite of rank and file is, I don't know if it has a name, it's getting hired as union staff.
Bureaucratic.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then my second question is, so you mentioned tunnel vision. I think it's, so I'm a teacher, I'm a professor at Westfield State University. I've spent an enormous amount of time, I've been on my union executive committee for the last 7 years. I think it's taken an enormous amount of energy to fight against my own faculty union leadership and get better local and at Westfield State, and then fight against our statewide board. So we can swallow up enormous amounts of time that I sometimes ask myself, is this really the best use of my time? But my more theoretical question about the rank and file strategy is, at least within the EDU and in Massachusetts, we've really lucked out by getting Margaret Mataloni elected president of the statewide MTA, and now back to Mary Max. And so there has been a lot of focus on getting sort of maybe like a fine rank and file strategy to get leadership positions, whether it's in our own local, statewide. And I'm just wondering, but then just in terms of some of the limits of unions, I'm wondering if there's any thinking, strategizing, theoretizing within the rank and file strategy about some of the limits that puts you in and the contradictions, just like electoral strategy, we're getting elected to, whether it's city council or mayor or whatever, within a capitalist system, and we become the managers of austerity, and there's a lot of pressures and limits on us. So I'm just wondering, I'm just curious, to what extent does the rank and file address that? How do we hold our elected rank and file of union officers accountable? How do we democratize unions in a way that, I also think the issue of, whether it's in a revolution or whether it's in a union of again, holding leaders accountable, because we've seen so many examples of revolutions that seem to start off with very good people who then, revolutions go awry. So, I don't know, that's sort of very broad.
Dominic, no, Dominic.
Yeah, no, why don't we get all that up?
Maybe I have three, but I'm going to try to keep two questions. One of them is a question I have about the rank and file.
Name, pronouns, and what area of work you're involved.
Okay, my name is Dominic. I use he, him pronouns. I work in construction. I'm a member of IBW Local 103 here in Boston. I have a question about the rank and file strategy, or about, I guess, like the politics behind rank and file. I find in my union, there is sort of a cluster of people that are, you know, that are rank and file, that are maybe disgruntled, maybe frustrated with the union leadership, or they just kind of find themselves like at odds with the bureaucracy or something like that. And a lot of times those people get cast, or cast themselves as sort of underdogs, but don't have a clear goal. It's more of an identity than like a strategy, I guess. So one question that I've tried to ask myself, and I'd like to ask you all, is why rank and file? If what you're talking about is making change, some people would say that you can just make change, you know, from the leadership, that it's not really important. And really, I'm asking this to you as your coworker. Why should we be active as rank and file workers? And my other question is for Laura, is why is the construction industry strategic for socialists, or to build socialism?
Well, that last question that you asked about the why not just do it from the leadership, I mean, EDU is such a good example of that, I think. we had this incredibly, smart, militant, totally dedicated socialist in leadership, but there was so little that she could do, and it really needed to come, even though that was a huge thing that we accomplished, and it had this trickle-down effect, sort of, we were trickling up and down at the same time or something, of helping with funding and what was on the agenda of MTA and that sort of thing. There was only so much that could be done without more people involved in our approach to rank and file organizing. So, you know, the strike example is a perfect one. How could we ever pull off a statewide strike if the president is like, let's go strike, and nobody follows? I don't know. Let's see. There's something else I wrote down here. Let me see if you remember. It might have been in response to what Mara said. Or maybe kind of Donna. So this idea of, it's more mostly an acknowledgement. This idea of we don't get to that conversation. And that's kind of where John started at too. The whole point of the rank and file strategy is for socialists and union people to get together and talk about socialism and get closer to that. And realizing, you know, that does seem like that's the place that you don't go very often. In my mind, without even really thinking it through, I've been realizing that to me, my eyes are on the next step of bringing people in my local to see common cause with other workers, unions in the area. So, you know, that's kind of like where I can imagine going next. And that's great, but, you know, I should also be thinking in terms of, but what about that other thing? You know, and then EDU, certainly education is very visibly tied in with capitalist profit taking and potential for, you know, we're kind of holding the line from preventing the whole education system from being made into a profit-making enterprise even more than it already is. But so there's potential for having those conversations, and I think that sort of thing did come out with the Question 2 campaign and so on. But yeah, it's hard to imagine how to really get to that conversation in a deep way.
Yeah, I mean, these are great questions, right? I mean, obviously, a lot more theoretical needs to be done. But I think, so when EDU first was contemplating running a candidate for office, one of my union mentors just straight up says, that's a terrible mistake. You know, you're not ready yet. Like, you haven't built the sufficient, you know, networks, organization within the union. And I agreed with her. But then it was one of the things that was surprising. And so again, part like it's so hard too, because Barbara Mataloni is just, for folks that don't know her, she's such a unique individual. We were really lucky that that was our candidate. I mean, so I think there's a difference between kind of joining forces with the already existing labor leadership, right? Versus trying to get one of your own elected, right? So, I mean, Barbara did come from a caucus. I mean, she was accountable to us. When she turned out and we decided to run somebody again, we had a process. We had basically a primary, but all people who had decided to be members of the, who put their name forward to be a candidate, all decided that if they didn't get the nomination of EDU, then they would be on the election committee of the person that did get it, right? And so I think that is a different, right? That's different than just saying, oh, that looks like that progressive leadership over there. You know, they look progressive, and maybe it would be good to try and make common cause with them. Now, I think a couple of problems arise. One is kind of, and you know, Kim Moody goes into this in the document. I mean, there is union leadership. You know, like sociologically, they take on a different position in society, right? Like they are now wealthy. I mean, it's embarrassing how much the president of the Mass Teachers Association makes. And they should. And Barbara agreed with that. And she gave much of it away towards union causes because she was embarrassed about how much she makes. But, you know, very few folks do that, right? She was pretty unique. And so you begin to kind of start to live a different lifestyle. I mean, then Harvard invites you to one of their programs for, you know, emerging leaders. And, you know, they teach you how to drink port. Yeah, and so there's all of these ways, all of these pressures, and then like, hey, you know, it's reasonable, and you're dressing that, and then, I mean, so like, you do then offer exists in a kind of like a distinctive sociological position in society, which means that your interests don't line up with the ranks, right? Because your interest is the maintenance, so labor peace. Right, you got to maintain labor peace because that's your primary job, and you need to maintain the existence of the union in its current form. Right, so if you have rank and filers saying let's go wildcat, like, you know, I mean, it's illegal for teachers to strike in Massachusetts. The president of my local would, you know, clearly not want that. Right, it would be extraordinarily expensive, and so there are tremendous limits on what. Elected officers can do if there isn't pressure coming from elsewhere, I think is part of the answer. And so both in terms of their kind of sociological position in terms of well-paid bureaucrats, but also in terms of like their interest in maintaining the well-being of the union in its current form, really makes it so that they're only going to push so far, right? And ultimately they're only going to push as far as the ranks are going to push. So I think, you know, I mean, there's so much here, I'm not exactly sure what I'm answering, but
yeah, just picking up on that last point too, I don't necessarily, in kind of responding, I don't know your name, I'm Dominic, I guess I don't necessarily think of it as being like rank and file, whether it's strategic. I mean, I guess to me the rank and file strategy is saying it's strategic to get a rank and file strategy and to organize from that position. But I don't think of it as a like some sort of purely like rank and file versus staff or versus bureaucrats thing. Like, to me, because I know people who are union staff who are like deeply committed to the rank and file strategy also. It just happened to be where they ended up first, and now they're at a point where they're not going to like change jobs, you know, at this late stage. I think it's more an understanding that there can be staff that are like very much contributing to it and helping it along. But as union staff, sometimes you're in the position to help do that, and sometimes you're not. And like your boss is who the leadership is. And if the leadership wants the union to be going in a certain direction, you know, at the end of the day, you have to like follow that to some extent. Otherwise they can get rid of you. You know, so there's people who like manage to get themselves into positions where they're able to do a ton from a staff role to contribute to like really good bottom up organizing. And I guess I wanted to make that point just because I consider anybody like that as much a part of the rank and file strategy as like people in a job, you know, a rank and file job. But and I guess to answer Dominic's point really quick, just that I was looking back on like why we considered construction strategic, just so I didn't forget anything. But basically, it is still though I feel like those trades have been like going through a process of being de-skilled in a bunch of ways, and including the carpenters very much. It is still a skilled trade where you have the power to stop production, you have the power to shut down an industry. It can potentially be extremely costly, like day by day, to not be working. I know you know this, but like huge loans are taken out to build. There's interest on those loans, so every day that there's people not working, it's just racking up. You know, they're on really tight deadlines all the time. It also there's the potential to specifically target private developers, which I think there's some really important possible intersections there with housing work and anti-gentrification and displacement work. Where if you were ever able to get the organized working class fighting on something like that, it could be extremely powerful. Relatively low barriers to entry, so it's not like you have to go to school for 6 years to become a carpenter. You can just go right in with a high school diploma. You can start organizing right away in some capacity. And then the sort of the eco-socialist perspective that I was talking to, that for a Green New Deal or a massive project like that, the jobs would be construction jobs. It should be something that we're fighting for right now, and our leadership is like weird. Like, I guess I should expect it, but like they're like dead set against it. I went to the National Building Trades Political Conference in April, and I was even shocked at the level. And I don't feel like much shocks me in the building trades anymore. I was shocked at the level at which they like came out really hard against the Green New Deal, and I'm like, this is gonna create many, many more jobs than it's gonna take away. Like, it is taking away some jobs, you know, in certain places, but it's gonna create a lot more. So it's something we should honestly be aligned with or getting on the same page with. So in that way, I consider it strategic. And that's, I'll leave it there. We already went through it.
Any questions?
Sanjeev E from PBDSC. So, you know, something that, and a member of FBA as well. So, something that sort of struck me with a bit is so, one issue is within unions, you know, what's the best thing to do? And the other is sort of whether unions fundamentally are not in sync at this point in history as a form of labor organization. I mean, that's a question, not a decision. So unions themselves, I think the pastor or someone here said, evolved, you know, from gangs, trade unions, craft unions, and so on. And should we be taking them for granted as that is the form of working class organization that we should be focusing on the most? Are there other forms? Are there things that are happening, I don't know if the lecture is sort of the goal, but why are we taking this for granted that a a 250-year-old fall from disease is the one that we should be putting hard stop in. As socialists, and you know, why are we doing so?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's, you know, it's, it does get it, but where we have the most likely possible collective power to actually, again, I mean, you know, to stop production, right? And so unions are the place where that is more likely to happen, right? Even when they're, you know, even when they're, you know, in all sorts of bad, right? I mean, you know, the Chicago Teachers Union before the CORE took over, that was not, you know, we wouldn't be looking to Chicago about, like, you know, hey, look at that great union and all the work that they're doing. But then this caucus came in, they actually functioned as almost like a dual union for a while, a union within the union, kind of doing the work as the union. And then people were like, well, you guys are doing all this work so great, you should just really leave the union. And then they had this massive strike that was, you know, I mean, again, we don't want to claim any easy victories, right? But it was pretty widely successful, not least of all is because it then unleashed the idea that the strike was back on the agenda in a way that, you know, it didn't feel like it could have been. And it's not clear, you know, obviously, you know, there are worker centers, there's, you know, there's organizations that connect with workers as community members, right? And so obviously making those links are really important. You know, Jobs with Justice is an incredibly important organization, right? In terms of like helping to, you know, to think about the whole worker and not just the worker exclusively as worker. But without that capacity to, you know, to stop, you know, production, whether it's education or otherwise, it's not clear what other form of organization we have available to us that could actually do it.
Had a little point and a larger point, I guess. When you were talking about why organizing unions earlier, did you mention money?
Yeah.
Okay, because I think I missed it. But just the access to money and resources is also important. Somebody who spoke about the Richmond Progressive Alliance at an event that I went to talked about how critical labor support was in terms of funding. You know, where else is there that much money? MTA has a budget of $45 million. So that's just a thought. I don't know.
It's membership money, right? That's the other thing too. Yeah. Like, it's, you don't have to go back to some millionaire and say, hey,
right,
we're going to do this with the money. It's
no prestige.
Right. It's the members' money.
And then I don't have a really good grounding in theory and ability to point to this and that. My ideas are very vague, but I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is effectively, you know, like we don't really need to take the state as socialists. You know, maybe we need to, it's a similar, I'm not saying that you're saying this, but you're entertaining this idea. It's kind of like just as socialists, we need to take the state. The state is messed up and we'll transform it. Cross our fingers. But yeah, it's like it is what it is, and there isn't anything else on that scale like unions that bring workers together and that have the power that exists there. So I'm not sure that we're in a position to start something new and different. You have to start with that.
It is 1:30. I did see another hand. So I don't know.
Maybe just I'll wrap up. Okay. Make sure it's not going to be
eaten. Okay. So let's see. So there are lunch recommendations here. There is the Northeastern Student Center at 360 Huntington. There's Cadova at 393 Huntington. And there's Amelia's Tuckery at 309 Huntington. So apparently we can get three of them.
So then we're all in the 300 block.